receive peace and prosperity on this earth. I hope that you enjoy your visit to Cuba. This is not a country that is rich in material wealth, but it is a country that is rich in human wealth, spiritual wealth, and moral wealth. Respectfully yours, Asada Shakur, Havana, Cuba.
That was Asada Shakur reading an open letter to the Pope in 1998. The Black liberation activist died on Thursday at the age of 78 in Cuba, where she had political asylum. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Paul Powell. This coming weekend, I'll be speaking Saturday, October 4th, at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco, doing a Q&A after the Jewish Film Institute's special documentary screening of Steal the Story, Please, a new documentary about Democracy Now! Sunday, October 5th, I'll be in Berkeley at BAMFA for a screening of the documentary, again with the Oscar-nominated directors Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl. On Friday, October 17th, I'll be in Santa Fe at the Lenz Theater, and October 18th and 19th at the Woodstock Film Festival. Go to democracynow.org for details. I'm Amy Goodman.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are feeling sad, struggling with alcohol or drug use, or just need someone to talk to. Trained counselors are able to listen and provide support 24/7. Confidential support is available by text or phone call to 988. More information is available at 988oregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, President Donald Trump and Secretary of War Pete Hegseth authorize National Guard troops in Portland.
Portland City Councilor Mitch Green encourages deployment military in our city to reject illegal orders from the Trump administration.
And the Oregon Senate passes a long-awaited transportation bill.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 20th, 2025. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Terrence Burns. President Donald Trump ordered the deployment of 200 Oregon National Guard members and other federal agents into Portland over the weekend. That's despite pleas from Oregon Governor Tina Kotek and Portland Mayor Keith Wilson and other local elected leaders. Trump tweeted, calling on the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, to provide troops to, quote, "war-ravaged Portland," he said. They're authorized to use, quote, "full force if necessary." It is unclear what full force means. The Trump administration says they authorized 200 National Guard members to Portland as part of a larger deployment of troops to cities across the country. Within hours, Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield sued to block the National Guard deployment. Rayfield says federalizing the National Guard without a rebellion or insurrection happening and without Kotek's permission is illegal. Local elected leaders have called upon Portlanders to, quote, not take the bait, but encourage them to exercise their right to peaceful protest. Some protested in downtown Portland over the weekend. Others gathered at the ice processing facility on Southwest Macadam Avenue. That's been the site for over 100 nights of protest by around 24 people. KBOO spoke with a protest medic, Gray, a few weeks ago about why their protest matters.
Having our presence on the ground allows us to say how many people are being taken in those GEO vans that leave and go to the concentration camp in Tacoma, because that's what it is. It's a detention center, but let's be real, it's a concentration camp. So we are marking how many people are going in, also to their appointments, and who aren't coming back out. So that way, other organizations like PERC, groups that are working with immigrants and especially detained immigrants, have that knowledge of what is actually happening and what to look out for and who to look out for. Taking on the brunt of a lot of the attention of ICE, because if they're focusing on us, they're not as much in the community. That's one of the ways they're using their resources, is by focusing on us, by us being down there.
The size of the protest at the Macadam facility has grown in response to the troop deployment.
Federal officers grabbed two people in front of the Macadam ICE facility yesterday. Crowds in front of the facility grew to a couple hundred before thinning out, the Oregonian reports. The protests were largely peaceful with notable exceptions. Video from independent journalist Kevin Foster show three officers in military fatigues carrying a protester into the facility by holding their arms and legs. Another video shows a group of five officers dragging a demonstrator down the facility driveway. A Black Hawk helicopter was spotted circling the immigration center Sunday evening. The Oregonian identified it as an ICE helicopter. The Federal Aviation Administration issued temporary flight restrictions for South Portland for, quote, special security reasons. The FBI and ICE arrested someone who they allege aimed a laser at a helicopter that was being used by Customs and Border Protection. They issued three more people, rather, they arrested three more people at that person's residence who they say were in the U.S. illegally. According to the FBI, those people are now in ICE custody. The Portland Police Bureau also confirmed two arrests at the demonstrations last night. The two people PPB arrested are not the same people that were grabbed by ICE at the demonstrations. Both PPB arrests were for assault. Their press release said that the arrests occurred after altercations between, quote, protesters with opposing viewpoints, end quote, and a group of right-wing agitators and media gathered outside the facility. One arrest was a 17-year-old. The other arrest was a 38-year-old man. In court testimony last week, PPB said that federal cops are, quote, instigating confrontations with protesters. A spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security said that accusation was, quote, disgusting.
A protest organized by the ACLU of Oregon drew out 1,000 participants in Tom McCall Waterfront Park on Sunday. Rallygoers included older folks and families with kids, holding signs with messages like, "Feds out of Portland," "Abolish ICE," "Wake up America," and "Leave us alone." KBOO's Althea Billings has more.
While a few hundred protesters assembled outside the Southwest Portland ICE facility on Sunday, around 1,000 rallied at Waterfront Park, organized by the ACLU of Oregon. Governor Tina Kotek and Portland Mayor Keith Wilson addressed the crowd, alongside a number of other local leaders. Kotek told the crowd, quote, "We do not want military intervention in Oregon anywhere, whether Portland or any other city in Oregon. You are peacefully exercising your constitutional rights. You are making your voices heard, and I love you for that," end quote. After the rally, protesters marched through downtown. I caught up with a few participants along the route.
No hate, no ICE in our state. No fear, no hate.
James held a sign that read, "Oppression is the mask of fear."
This is actually a quote from the TV show Andor. So I thought it was very fitting for this, and it is an indication that all this is posturing. Whenever they try to clamp down, it's actually they're masking the fact that they're very afraid. Trump announced that he was sending military troops here, so I figured I needed to be out here on this specific protest because of that.
Christina says her faith motivates her to action.
As Christians, we care, and we do something about it. So when people are being hurt and threatened, and when freedom of speech, when freedom of religion are being taken away, then we stand up.
I would love to see the whole church out here and learning what it means to be anti-racist and what it looks like to love people and to stand up for people who don't look like you or vote like you or sound like you. Yeah, I would love for our government to care about somebody other than themselves. That would be awesome. I would love for ICE to stop terrorizing people.
Hannah Herod is the co-director of the Rural Organizing Project. She carried a clipboard with information to connect people to more ways to help.
I'm out here today because Oregon is home, and there are so many folks all around the state who are really desperately in need of resources like healthcare and housing and food access. And instead, this federal administration is spending a ton of money to send federal agencies to cities around the U.S. So the rural connection here, I mean, what happens in, you know, any part of Oregon affects all of us, right? We're all interconnected. So that's a big piece of this. And, you know, rural Oregonians all around the state are also working on building these configurations in their communities. So Rural Organizing Project has a network of over 90 member groups that are organizing around human dignity and democracy and are connecting up with other folks in urban spaces around how do we have shared analysis around this moment of authoritarian consolidation that we're in? What does it mean to like prepare people and bring folks in on a bigger scale than we've ever done before, which we'll need if we want to have a hope to take down authoritarianism? And what does it mean to be training folks up and skilling people up to be moving in organizing groups that can really help hold this work for the long haul so that we don't just like respond in protest, have a burnout moment, and then everybody goes back to business as usual.
There's strength in numbers. Don't be afraid to stand up. What they want you to do is comply in advance. Give up your free speech rights without them ever actually having to do anything. Don't give in before they make you.
Depending on, you know, who you are, you may or may not be feeling the impacts of this yet. But what we've seen from how authoritarian governments move is that eventually everyone will feel the impact. And if we can all come together now and intervene, then we can actually build what we all need on the other side of this before it's too late.
Look around at what's being done, and if you don't 100% agree with that, then you need to do something now. Because anybody who disagrees is going to be picked off one by one until it's too late. So, and if you think you can't see the direction this is going, I think you're just kidding yourself, because it's pretty clear where it's going. So anything else, any wishful, hopeful thinking is going to hurt your neighbors.
I am excited about folks around the city of Portland being able to use this moment to get into more organized configurations. Protect Oregon is a coalition of organizations all around the state, and we're working to use this moment to bring folks into new organizing configurations neighborhood by neighborhood all across the city. And the hope is that out of those spaces, we'll be training folks up around mass noncompliance, around Negro Watch, around mutual aid within neighborhoods. So we're hopefully using this opportunity as folks are like coming into action because they don't want federal troops on our streets to also be able to help invite folks into next steps. So you can go to protectoregon.org if you're excited to get more information about how to plug in your neighborhood.
For KBOO News, I'm Althea Billings.
Portland City Councilor Mitch Green is calling on military members to push back against Trump's orders in the city. Green is an Army veteran, and he posted a video to his Instagram page in his military uniform condemning the deployment order from the president.
Portland, I'm talking to you today because we are facing an illegal and unprecedented assault on our civil rights by the Trump administration. I'm your city councilor for District 4, but I'm also speaking to you as a former soldier. And I have a special message to all my fellow veterans out there and those still serving. I'm asking you to remember your oath of service, to engage in that sense of duty cultivated while in service, and use your voice to speak out in opposition to the Trump administration and its unlawful designs for Portland. Show up in your uniform, protest this administration, and talk to your fellow vets, neighbors, and families about how deeply wrong all of this is. For those of you still serving, I want to remind you that your oath of service requires you to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That oath does not grant the president a right to your absolute obedience. You have not only the right, but the duty to disobey an unlawful order. Many of you will face a difficult choice in the coming days. Comply with deployment orders to occupy an American city, or refuse those orders and face the consequences. But know that if you choose to refuse out of a higher sense of duty to the Constitution, that you won't be alone. There's a group called About Face that offers support for service members who request peer or legal support when you make that choice. Please know that there is a strong community of service members and veterans here to support you in the fight against fascism, and I would encourage you to get in touch with them. Thank you for your service.
That was Portland City Councilor and Army veteran Mitch Green calling on service members to reject illegal orders to deploy in Portland.
The Oregon Senate passed a long-awaited transportation bill Monday by a vote of 18 to 11. House Bill 3991 is expected to raise over $4 billion over the next 10 years to fund road maintenance and operations. It will raise the state gas tax by 6 cents and phase in a mandatory road usage charge program for electric vehicles by 2031. State senators debated for roughly 25 minutes as Senate Republican leader Bruce Starr of Dundee attempted to block the bill from moving forward by offering two amendments. The first, free up existing funds with the Oregon Department of Transportation's budget and allowed the agency to direct it to immediate needs. The second amendment would give Oregon voters the final say on whether to approve or reject the bill in November's general election. Both motions failed. Senate Republicans requested a caucus meeting and then held a press conference to explain their amendments. Starr said he and Republicans don't want state roadways to deteriorate for transportation employees to lose their jobs. They went on to criticize Governor Tina Kotek and Democrats for not collaborating on bipartisan transportation solution. Starr says he and Republicans would work to create a referendum or allow Oregon voters to reject or approve the legislation in the November 2026 election. Oregon Democrats during the floor debate expressed support for the bill. Some called the bill a good start, while others called the same bill insufficient. Courtney Naren Milson, Democrat, Wilsonville, explained her disappointment, quote, "It does not reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. It does not address seismic vulnerabilities. It does not reflect the testimonies calling for clean air and reliable transit. So yes, I am disappointed, but I'm certainly voting yes because the bill is necessary to keep essential services of transit," end quote. The Oregon House of Representatives passed the bill on September 1st, but a Senate vote was postponed twice because Senator Chris Gorsuch, Democrat of Gresham, was recovering from surgery, and Democrats needed his vote to pass the bill.
Arkansas teens weigh in on free speech, Social Security, paper checks, and domestic violence experts warn of funding cuts. With that story and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The Republican Party especially has kind of used Charlie Kirk as a symbol to suppress free speech, whether it's late night TV show hosts or J.D. Vance encouraging people to report people who said things.
Arkansas high school senior Ariana Minkle says they're watching teachers get fired for online comments about the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. Minkle and some of her peers host a youth podcast on community radio in Little Rock, and she says they're concerned to see political speech censored. Michigan authorities identified the gunman who they say rammed a pickup into a packed Mormon church and opened fire, killing two. They haven't said what the motive of 40-year-old Thomas Jacob Sanford, an Iraq war vet, was. President Donald Trump meets with congressional leaders today in a last-ditch bid to avoid a government shutdown. Tomorrow, he plans to address an unusual gathering of high-ranking military officers. That meeting is being described as a pep rally for the services. Domestic violence shelters say funding cuts and confusion about policy changes will put the lives of survivors and their children at real and immediate risk. The White House now says shelters can't use federal funds to take in undocumented migrants or offer specific protections to trans individuals. Krista Colon leads the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence.
If I offer a night of shelter to someone who may be an undocumented, is my entire funding at risk? If I respect an individual's pronoun, am I now going to be a target? Funding levels have never been enough, but federal funding is a cornerstone for programs nationwide.
Tomorrow is the last day to qualify for federal tax credits of up to $7,500 on new electric vehicles, ended in the Republican budget mega bill. Critics argue that will undermine clean energy jobs, but Ohio GOP Senator Bernie Moreno says the government shouldn't be picking car market winners and losers.
It's not about what kind of car I like or I don't like. What it's about is letting the marketplace choose. So get rid of all the incentives, get rid of all the mandates.
Advocates for seniors are warning about the phase out of paper Social Security checks that starts tomorrow. More than 500,000 Americans will be forced to use direct deposit or prepaid debit cards. Maria Freese with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare says that could be tough for some rural and low-income seniors.
They may or may not read the material that comes in with their checks. They may or may not understand the material. And they may not have any idea that this is coming.
The administration says it'll improve security. Critics argue it risks payment delays for folks without bank accounts and gives a windfall to some payment companies. New York City Mayor Eric Adams has ended his re-election campaign amid extensive accusations of corruption. Adams was running far behind Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KABU News in Depth.
At 6 o'clock, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, expect the rain to taper off by early morning with clouds and windy conditions. Overnight lows in the mid-50s. Tomorrow's weather, look for an afternoon rain with a high of 68 degrees. Today in history, American singer and pianist Jerry Lee Lewis was born September 29, 1935. Lewis was both revealed and revered by critics and music fans alike for his wild man antics. He was one of the most notorious musicians in rock and roll history. The quote of the day is from Irish poet and author and playwright, critic Oscar Wilde, who said, quote, "There is only one thing in the world worse than being talked about, and that's not being talked about."
The father of Emily Pike has filed a civil lawsuit against the Mesa, Arizona area group home Sacred Journey, Inc., that held the San Carlos Apache teen in its custody before she went missing and was murdered. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The father of Emily Pike has filed a civil lawsuit against the Mesa group home that had the San Carlos Apache teen in its custody before she went missing and was murdered in Arizona. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has details.
The 7-page complaint alleges Sacred Journey, Inc. group home staff were negligent in failing to keep Emily in their care, blaming them for her, quote, wrongful death.
If they had kept her safe, would this have happened? We don't know.
Olivia Lamaracco is with the Phillips Law Group. The Department of Child Safety found back in April a few deficiencies, but once the facility corrected them, no further action was taken.
Their investigation came too late, unfortunately, for Emily. I know they've made small changes, but it doesn't change the facts of what happened.
The personal injury law firm in Phoenix is representing Emily's biological dad, Jensen Pike, who has been behind bars since before she disappeared in late January. He's seeking unspecified damages for forever being deprived of his child.
You know, I can't speak for any other family member or Emily's mom. The answer is I don't know. if she's pursuing anything.
Sacred Journey Inc. did not respond for comment, but has 20 days to reply to his complaint that also looks to recoup funeral and burial costs. The San Carlos Apache tribe provided at least $5,000 for Emily's funeral, but that didn't cover everything. Emily's remains were found in garbage bags back in February along an Arizona highway, over 100 miles away from where she was last seen at the group home. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Billings, Montana hosted its second annual Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Vigil and Community Meal to honor loved ones and rally around justice and healing. Yellowstone Public Radio's Kayla DeRoche has more.
Advocacy group Warrior Women for Justice convened the vigil Friday morning with a smudging ceremony on the Yellowstone County Courthouse lawn. Nikki Wege with Warrior Women for Justice is of Selka and Umaha and says this gathering is an opportunity for community members to honor their loved ones in solidarity.
To not only remember the stolen, but to bring awareness, seek advocacy, seek justice and accountability, and to speak for those who have been silenced.
According to a 2020 report from the Montana Department of Justice, Indigenous people make up less than a tenth of the state's population, but roughly 25% of all missing persons.
Today, it does not matter if you call upon the Lord to hear your prayers or if you turn to all four directions while burning sacred herbs to lift your pleas. What matters today is standing together as one to roll away the stone that's blocking the government and the media and our own families and communities from acting. We stand together to give life to hope.
After speeches and reading a list of the missing and murdered, attendees share a meal, stories, and healing crafts like painting and weaving. Wege says Warrior Women for Justice will roll out a series of recordings from the event to highlight some of those stories. For National Native News, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
Ernie Stevens Jr. is being remembered for his contributions to Indian Country, serving as chairman of the Indian Gaming Association for more than two decades. Stevens, a citizen of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin, passed away suddenly on Friday at age 66. The Indian Gaming Association says Stevens was a strong advocate for Native rights, and his legacy includes a record of policy victories and economic achievements in Indian gaming. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Nearly 30,000 children in Washington lost health insurance during the national Medicaid unwinding process from 2022 to 2024, according to new research. Children's health advocates warn that this process, combined with massive cuts and increased red tape, will lead to many more children losing insurance across the country. KBOO's Corvin Vail has more.
Washington's post-pandemic Medicaid unwinding from 2022 to 2024 left 28,000 children uninsured, raising the state's rate from 2.8 to 3.9%. That rate is expected to grow across the U.S., according to new research from the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families. Washington fared better than the rest of the country, where the uninsured child rate spiked from 5.1 to 6% during this period, representing more than 5.5 million children, the highest increase in a decade. Joan Alker of the Georgetown Center says the blow was gentler on Washington because the state has been focused on getting and keeping children insured.
Washington is really a leader in what we call the continuous eligibility policy for children 0 to 6. Washington pioneered that and got a Section 1115 waiver, and they said they really learned a lot from the continuous coverage period, and they wanted to offer that.
Alker warns that the loss of waivers, along with unprecedented cuts to Medicaid, increased red tape, and expiring subsidies, will continue to cause eligible children to lose coverage. She adds that 1 in 4 U.S. children has an immigrant parent, and the growing fear within immigrant communities of sharing personal information with the government will also lead to more uninsured children. Section 1115 waivers grant states flexibility to experiment with new approaches that promote the objectives of Medicaid, such as expanding eligibility. The Trump administration announced in July that they are rescinding those waivers.
Chaos and confusion caused by misinformation and discussions of cuts to come all erode the more welcoming climate that existed in recent years.
Data shows that investing in children's health care is good for families, and it's also good for the economy. Children who have access to Medicaid grow up healthier, have better educational outcomes, and even pay more taxes as adults. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Corvin Vale.
Tomorrow is the last day you can qualify for federal tax credits when buying an electric vehicle. Conservation groups blame the Republican One Big Beautiful Bill Act for the loss of tax credits. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
The federal tax credits that could save you $7,500 on a new electric vehicle and $4,000 on a used EV expire tomorrow night. The Republican One Big Beautiful Bill Act will rescind the Biden-era program. Ingrid Malmgren with the nonprofit Plug In America says consumer tax credits for new and used EVs made them affordable for millions of Americans.
People who didn't have tax liability could take advantage of them. People who didn't want to have to finance as much of the vehicle, it not only saved them money on the price of the vehicle, but they had to finance less.
The tax credits were designed to fight climate change by creating more demand for EVs. They also created jobs at places like the Tesla Gigafactory in Storey County, which makes electric motors, energy storage products, vehicle powertrains, and EV batteries. Malmgren says the Trump administration has gone all out to boost oil company profits after the companies made huge donations to his campaign.
There's been a lot of money spent in the 2024 election cycle by oil and gas interests, and this appears to be the administration and congressional leadership's way of paying back for all of those donations and funding.
Supporters of the Republican bill say that the savings created by repealing the tax credits are needed to fund other administration priorities. Opponents counter that the loss of the tax credits will hobble the American EV industry and undermine energy security, economic growth, and innovation. For Nevada News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The nonprofit Work for Climate is helping employees push their companies to go green. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story.